The Cultural and Outdoor Resources Finance Division will come to order Wednesday, March 25th. I welcome new faces in the audience, and I assume the new faces in the audience are librarians because it's Library Legislative Day at the Capitol. I'm so sorry you weren't here Monday night when we needed you. But that being said, we moved right along and we have an understanding of kind of where the library fit in the tax, from the tax perspective and the maintenance of the effort. Members of the committee at the Finance Committee and at the working group that was created Monday night after we adjourned, we went up to House Research with Pat Dalton, who is the fiscal analyst, the nonpartisan staff fiscal tax person that was working on maintenance of efforts. And we had a working group. And at that group, I spoke on behalf of the committee without your permission. But I think I was reflecting most of our views. And that is that maintenance of effort was put in for specific purposes and we shouldn't just cast it aside. And that it is very important to the library, city, county, regional. And that we always have to remember that the state librarian is part of any discussions about funding, because they deliver the funding. The state librarian's office delivers the funding and is responsible, has the fiscal fiduciary responsibility. That being said, we did reach, with the help of the Library Association representatives that were there, Mr. Rann and Ms. Keith, language that we could all work with, I guess. And so the bill traveled on from finance. But I said that if there was a whole lot of messing around with Section 2, we were going to pull the back the bill. And so they're on warning that we'll go so far, but not further. And that being said, we love our libraries, and we love our librarians. But the librarians should be talking to state representatives more than one day a year. And they should be speaking to the state representatives in their areas at home about how the systems work and mesh together, because every time we try to figure it out, we learn something new, and we need, each representative needs a greater understanding of what you take for granted every single day about where your money comes from. But that being said, every year, the Legislative Auditor's Office asks for suggestions on what their topic should be for the next year, or for the biennium, for them to issue reports. And Representative Solberg, the Chair of Ways and Means, and I and several other representatives submitted to the legislative auditor our idea of what should be looked at, and that was the Minnesota Library System funding. Because in this maintenance of effort thing, we found that some per capita areas are paying over $100 per capita for a library service, and some are paying $3.12. Now, how fair is that? And things have changed since it was first put into action. And so we have to think about what changes can be made. Now, I talked to the Carlton County Library in Cloquet, and she said she's been working for 20 years on committees. And I talked to my very own personal librarian who's sitting over there, Beth Kelly, and she says she's been working on 2 or 3 committees for 100 years. And Sue Nimitz up there, who used to work for my very committee in this building as my fiscal analyst, as the fiscal analyst for Judiciary Finance, she's a Ramsey County librarian. She says, oh my gosh, changes need to be made. And so I'm putting down on number 6 as my choice for the legislative legislative auditor, I'm putting number 6 as my first choice. And maybe other representatives will too. And it'll emerge in a blue book of recommendations next year. It's a good idea. And so if you're visiting today, tell your local representatives that you should, hey, check off number 6 on the legislative auditor's report. That's your assignment for today, librarian.
Hard for them to.
Thank you very much for coming. Now, today in your packet is a spreadsheet that has the governor's recommendations on it. And we don't have the targets yet because they haven't been through Ways and Means and accepted yet, but it's pretty much what was, I expect that it'll be pretty much what was brought forth last Friday, and which makes us have a reduction, if it was across the board, of about 7.84%, about $9 million less than base. So, if we're going to meet those targets, we can do either follow the governor's recommendations that she's suggesting, or we can make some changes that add some money to things. And today's going to be our last chance probably to ask any of our accounts questions, and I see familiar faces across from our agency. We are not going to be talking about the constitutional amendment today at all, or the constitutional amendment money. We are just going to be talking about the agency basis and what the agencies hope to do, what they told us they hope to do, and hope to receive as recommendations from this committee. We are also going to ask during this committee meeting from any of our agencies, can you raise any fees to bring some money into your account. And we welcome any suggestions on that. Representative Lilly, you have questions about one question that was left over from the library the other night. And you wanted to ask the State Department of Education library people that are here about the library at Faribault Academy, right?
That's correct, Madam Chair.
Could Ms. Watson, could you come down?
I'll be right there.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I have mine removed also.
Oh, then there won't be anything. There won't be any static then, the microphones. If you have cell phones, you're asked to turn them off because they raise havoc with our system. Ms. Walton, thank you for being here today. We know that Ms. Miller is in Chicago watching her daughter perform in Mary Poppins. And we're all very proud of her daughter. Sounds like it, yeah. I'm Nancy Walton, and I'm with the State Library Agency, which is State Library Services. And we are part of the Department of Education. The State Library Agency has a number of functions, and the function that I'm going to talk about this morning is the Minnesota Braille and Talking Book Library. Now, many of you know it as the Minnesota Library for Blind and Physically Handicapped, but the name was changed due to legislative action. So if I call it the Library for the Blind, my apologies, because it's hard to change old habits. Now, the Minnesota Braille and Talking Book Library is an interesting entity because it is a state library, but it provides public library services to a ever-growing clientele. Braille and Talking Book Library is located in Faribault. It's on the campus of the Minnesota State Academy for the Blind, but it is a separate entity from the academy. Because it's on the campus, it also serves as the school media center for the Academy for the Blind. The Library for the Blind program is actually a national program. It is out of the National Library Service for the Blind and Physically Handicapped, which is a branch of the Library of Congress. And each state has at least one library in the state that is designated as a partner in this federal program. The federal government provides the special cassette players that play four-track cassettes, because the books that are on cassette are actually on four tracks, not eight tracks, but four tracks. And part of the reason why they are in that special format is because of copyright reasons. They also provide books in Braille. They provide support materials in multiple formats, and they provide the machines to the state that are used for listening to the cassettes. Now, in most states, the machine lending agency is part of the Library for the Blind, but in Minnesota, the decision was made early in the program because the library is located in Faribault and at that time had a smaller population to draw from for volunteers to maintain and repair the equipment. State Services for the Blind is our partner in the state for the process because they take care of the equipment. The Library for the Blind has a clientele of almost 12,000 people. And the National Library Service says that the formulas they use to determine the potential audience is 1.4% of the total population of each state. So for the state of Minnesota, that would be over 70,000 people that are potential customers. Right now, we are struggling to serve 12,000 customers. And people say, well, who uses the Library for the Blind service? Well, the Library for the Blind service is a multi-tiered service. It provides books on cassette. It provides books in Braille. It also provides large print books, and it provides the support material. And most of the requests that come to the library are through telephone calls, through emails, and through letters. And the clientele that we have ranges in age from approximately 3 years old to over 81 people who are the age of 100, and they are active users of the library. You know, we talk to Minnesotans, because we have such a wide range, the library ends up wearing many hats. Because, for example, it's the media center for the Academy for the Blind, but it also provides resources to the school districts, because when they're looking for a copy of a particular novel that is being used in the classroom, they contact us first to see if we already have it on tape, or if we have it in Braille. The staff at the Academy for the Blind, most of the staff that have been there many, many years, we have some staff that have been there 30 years, and we have a director, we have a librarian, we have a customer service individual who assists the two librarians, the director and the librarian, with all of the telephone calls, and then we have a circulation support staff. These are the people that open the cartons, inspect the cassettes, rewind them, put them back in the cartons, scan the labels, put the materials on the shelves, match up the mailing labels with the cartons, and put them into the mail. The Library for the Blind averages about 300,000 items a year that go out to the approximately 12,000 customers. So it's a very labor-intensive process. The National Library Service is in the process of migrating to yet another format. When I was director there from 94 to 98, we had books on records, and we had magazines on records, we had the Braille, we had the cassette. Well, the records are gone, but now they are adding a digital format. And so they are slowly phasing in that program whereby the books will be recorded in a digital format and will be stored on a flash drive. And the flash drive, it will be inserted into a special digital machine. So we're going to end up with two different kinds of machines for a while as we transition. And eventually, over time, and it'll probably take at least 20 years, the four-track cassette tapes will still be in the library, and eventually they will go away. One of the difficulties for the Libraries for the Blind is that it's a very labor-intensive process. It's labor-intensive on the side of handling all of the materials as they come in and out of the library, including constantly turning the levers to move compact shelving in the basement. So it's not just the fine work on your hands, it's the overall physical movement. And because they have been short-staffed with the state hiring freeze and a number of retirements, and right now we have some workers' comp issues, we are down to a staff of 6.5 individuals, and that includes the director, and the 0.5 person is our maintenance person. And as a result, the library has had to shrink some of its services because there isn't enough staff to be able to do what needs to be done. Now, they have placed a cap on them, for example, because of workers' comp assessments that have been done over the years as to how long you can rewind, how long you can open cartons, how long that you will scan materials, because all of those are repetitive motion issues. And because of the staffing shortage, the staff of the State Library Agency for the next 5 weeks will be rotating down to the library one day a week in order to help out. The staff is absolutely thrilled to have us down there helping them. It also helps with bonding because Faribault is an hour's away and we don't always get to see the staff. People say, well, why is a direct service agency within the Department of Education when normally there isn't a direct service such as a library service? the Library for the Blind program goes back to 1933. And originally the library was part of the Academy for the Blind, but about 30 years ago the decision was made to move it to the Department of Education, to the State Library Agency, because when push came to shove in terms of budget, of course the budget of the activities at the Academy would be a higher priority than the library. It was a more natural fit to have a library within a library agency. The department has a process in place to fill vacancies. The approval goes through the department and goes on to what used to be DOER and to the Office of Management and Budget. We have not been able to fill the positions that remain vacant. When I was at the Library for the Blind, there were 11.5 people. Right now, there are 6.5 individuals. The people say, is there a mandate for the Library for the Blind service? And actually, it's in federal statute. It's part of the public law. In most states, the Library for the Blind is part of the state library agency or affiliated in some manner with the agency, although in some states there's a slightly different model. We are unusual because there are very few states that have the Library for the Blind on the campus of the Academy for the Blind. I think there's three of them left at this time. But one of the advantages for the city of Sarajevo and for the Academy for the Blind with having the library there is because it's a school media center, but it's also a safe workplace. The students at the Academy come and work for a few hours a day learning how to handle some of the materials, and so it's a quite safe working environment, and everybody benefits from it. We are all partners in this process. We have the federal government, we have the state government, we have the Academy for the Blind, and we also have our partnership with State Services for the Blind in order to provide the service to a group of well-deserving individuals. People say, where are your growth areas? Our growth areas are actually quite interesting because the Library for the Blind program has changed over time. Its primary priority is veterans. So when the new digital equipment comes in, the veterans will get first priority for getting the new equipment. After the veterans list has been met, then it will be offered to the individuals who are over the age of 100. And I wouldn't be surprised to have some of our 100-year-old customers ask for the new format, because some of them are using their computers to contact us at the Braille and Talking Book Library. But the other growth areas is that people don't realize that the Braille and Talking Book Library isn't just for people with visual impairment. It's also for people with physical disabilities, including temporary physical disability. So, for example, arthritis, where the book becomes too heavy for you to hold. People with an allergy to paper and ink. People with Tourette syndrome, where the spasms and other spasmodic movements where holding onto a book becomes difficult. And our real growth area is the veterans who are coming back from Afghanistan and from Iraq with injuries where they are no longer able to hold on to a book. And one of our secrets, because we are also for children who have reading disabilities due to an organic cause. And the reason why I call it a secret is because in many ways the Braille and Talking Book Library is one of the best kept secrets in the state. Because we don't have the staff to be able to do a marketing campaign, it's difficult for us to get the word out. We depend upon our colleagues in the library community to refer people to the library. We try and do outreach to the eye doctors across the state. But we have a huge potential market that we're not reaching at this time. Of course, if we were to have 70,000 customers with a group of 6.5 individuals, it would really be overwhelming. But it's an exciting possibility that as we all age and we develop problems with our bodies or with our eyes, is that there is an option like the Braille and Talking Book Library to enable us to continue to be active readers and processors of information.
Thank you so much, Ms. Walton. Two clarifications before I turn it over to Representative Lilly. You said there are 12,000 customers?
Yeah, there. I have the exact number here. Let's see here. There are 11,546 registered patrons. This was as of March 23rd.
Okay.
And it's about 5,400 female, 3,200 male, 81 people over the age of 100, and the average age is 65.7, and about 65% of the customers are over the age of 60.
And how many items did you say? 300,000?
Yes, over 300,000 items go out each year.
Okay.
And that number has had to drop because of the shortage of staff. And as a result, we've been getting complaints from our customers because we've had to reduce the hours that we have the telephone customer service, and we've had to put a cap on physical activity, so not as many materials are going out as we would normally process.
Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Walton,
mm-hmm.
I don't know if you're trying to help me or what, but I guess my questions are regards to staffing.
Mm-hmm.
And many times this morning, over and over, you've mentioned staffing and the impact to the workers, but the wear and tear on them, of course, and the customers you've mentioned, and then missed opportunities you've mentioned. So I think one of our goals all the time as legislators, we should try to maximize as many opportunities for partnerships that we could have. And you mentioned that you're partners with the federal government, the state, and on and on. My understanding is that because of the hiring freeze, that there is missed opportunity to maximize, if you will, employees that might be available if you were to hire. Now, I guess my question is fairly simple: is how many people do we need to hire to get access to the additional federal people, and who makes that decision? And how do we get there?
Representative Williams. At a minimum, we need to fill the, right now, the most recent change in staffing was a customer service individual. And so we need a customer service person, but we also need another person in the circulation area. There was a, if in the best of all possible worlds, we would need 12.5 individuals in order to do the level of service that the National Library Service for the Blind expects us to do. But at a minimum, we need to fill those two key positions because we have an individual who is already out on workers' comp, and that individual is not counted as part of the staffing count because we can't depend on whether she's going to be able to come back. She just recently had surgery due to a repetitive motion injury. Many of the staff members in the circulation area have had surgeries on their hands, their shoulders, and their arms because of the repetitive motion.
Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Walton, I'm not sure I'm quite getting the answer that I really want. So how many, the state, how many people do we need hired from the state? Is that true that if we hire people, if the state hires people, that they'll be matched by federal people? Yes or no, I guess this is the question. And then how many? And then who makes that decision? So three questions, I guess.
Certainly. Ms. Walton. Yes, Representative Willie. The funding for the library in Faribault is actually from two major sources. We have state funding and we have federal funding. And the federal funding is through the Library Services and Technology Act. The federal funding has to, any allocation has to fit within the state's five-year plan that is submitted to the federal government and approved. And within that plan, there is an element that is a federal focus. Actually, there are two elements. One is service to the elderly, and the second is service to people with disabilities. In the best of all possible worlds, we wouldn't be using federal funds in order to provide staffing at the libraries in Faribault, but the reality is that because funding is so tight, that the funding is a mix of state and federal funds. The state funds, we cannot use the federal funds for staffing that doesn't fit within the federal plan. So the staffing that fits within the federal plan is the customer service staff because it is direct service to the public. The state funding has to go to the behind-the-scenes staff, which would be the circulation staff. Decisions relating to spending any source of funds has to go through the Department of Education, and then from the Department of Education it goes on to the Office of Management and Budget. So we have submitted the paperwork. It has gone up through the many levels, but we have not been able to get an exemption from the state hiring freeze.
Ms. Walton, how much money is a circulation person?
Let's see here. Suzanne Miller gave me a proposed budget if we were to go up to full staff. Is that if we were to operate at the level that the federal government would like for us to operate for right now for the year 2009, we are spending approximately $358,000 in federal funds to support staff, and we are spending $233,200 for state funds for the librarian, the director, and the customer service staff. And then there are other expenses because it's a standalone building. Because we have an automation system and we have a new format that's coming in that will, for example, we have to purchase the flash drive postage. What I forgot to mention is that the federal government provides free postage for the mailing out of all of the materials from the Braille and Talking Book Library. It's part of the federal partnership. If we had to pay for the postage, it would really kick up the cost of this program. And this impacts all of you. I was at the library on Monday, and I was going through the mailing labels, and it was amazing all of the little towns that were on the mailing labels where people order books on tape or in Braille, and it goes right to their door, to their mailbox, or to the mail office of a retirement center. Of a school, whatever, and it's a service that literally goes from border to border across the state. It's not centered in any one area. Representative Lilly?
Madam Chair, Ms. Walton, I really strongly believe that we're all sold on the value of it. We're just trying to, to help you, actually, but maybe you're not getting my question. We're trying to... I mean, is there... So you send something on to the Department of Education, and then nothing happened, or is this? Am I in the? Are you in a process, or is your goal then to get people hired so you can get federal money to get your staffing at a level that we can offer folks that want your wonderful service? Is that
Ms. Walton.
We're really trying to help you.
Oh, yes, I can understand. We have had vacancies since 2003, and we have tried to fill those vacancies. But the most recent set of vacancies where it has become critical mass has been within the last year because we've had the retirements and the injuries. We submit as an agency the paperwork. It goes to the department, and then it goes on to the office, and the notification that we get is that it's not approved.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
My name is Brianna Chambers. I work at the Minnesota Department of Education.
Brianna?
Chambers.
All right.
And we would be glad to provide information for you on the precise cost of those staff members. Good. That was the question previously. So we can follow up with that information.
We would like that.
Great.
And we would like, Ms. Walton, you said that we have 12,000 customers, and then later on you mentioned 70,000, if we had 70,000 people, that would be really hard to deal with 6.5 staff. And I recognize that. So you think that the potential of service, of people to be served in Minnesota is 70,000?
Yes.
Okay.
Based upon the 1.4% of the population that the National Library Service uses for estimates. California did a marketing campaign.
That's fine. Thank you.
For the service, and it overwhelmed them completely because of the demand.
Representative Hodge.
Thank you, Representative Lilly. I want to pursue this for a while also. My little information comes from the day when the Association of the Blind Stay on the Hill, and one of their criteria on their sheet was that they were concerned, and if I kind of partially recall it, because of the freeze on state employees, they thought federal employees were caught up in that freeze also, and I tried to pursue this. You really don't have federal employees, though you have employees paid by federal dollars, correct?
Right.
Do you have less employees paid by federal dollars now than you had 2 years ago?
Absolutely, because of the vacancies. The customer service individual and what we would like to do, because as we switch to a digital format, is that we would like to change one of the circulation support positions or add a position that would become another customer service, because when we originally had three customer service individuals, and then we've gone down to one, we would like to at least go back to two.
Now, the Madam Chair.
Representative Hodge.
Thank you. The dollars that are not being used to fill the position of the state employee that was paid by the federal dollars, they're still in the budget, are they not?
Yes.
Those dollars.
Yeah. I'm sorry, Representative.
Thank you. Madam Chair.
Representative Hodge.
Then, if the governor's freeze wasn't on there, would you be using those dollars to hire those state employees paid for by federal dollars?
Ms. Walton.
Yes, Representative. The way the budget is set up for the federal dollars is that the money comes to the state library agency and we allocate funds. Part of the funds go towards the competitive grant program, part of the funds go to interagency grievance with Minitech, and part of the funds are set aside to hopefully fill the vacancies that occur in the library. If we are not able to fill the libraries, we have a list of projects that we will transfer the funds to in order to ensure that money is not returned to the federal government because it's not spent during the course of the 2 years that we have to spend the funding.
Madam Chair.
Representative Hodge.
Would you say, though, that your highest priority need is in personnel, is in people?
Ms. Walton. Madam Chair and Representative, the Braille and Talking Book Library is a direct service. it is a very important clientele, and it is a priority to the agency, and because it is so short-staffed, it is our highest priority. As a librarian, and I'm going down there and I'm opening cartons and rewinding cassettes because we haven't been able to fill the position. I think that's, including the state librarian, is rotating down to the library. We all care very much about it, and it is a number one priority for us, is to ensure that adequate staffing is there in order to provide the best service that we can provide.
Madam Chair.
Representative Hawk.
So when the governor put the freeze on for hiring employees, the federal dollars do not go down, but the priority shifts to some other part of the budget. Is that correct?
Yes. Yes. Is that if we're not able to spend it on staff, we shift it to other priorities that are on our list.
I think we have framed the problem. Thank you, Madam Chair.
You. Ms. Chambers, when you send the information that you previously talked about to us, could you also talk to us about what happened to the federal money? What the federal money was spent on?
Madam Chair, specifically the places that those federal dollars that Nancy mentioned, those lower tier priorities that
yes.
Followed the staff.
Yes.
Yes, we could do that.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Representative Brown.
I think it's becoming clearer and clearer, so I don't know if my question is still relevant, but when I look at the numbers you had said that you had gone from 11.5 FTEs down to the 6.5, and the vacancies started in 2003, is that correct?
Yes.
And I was wondering, of the difference in FTEs, how many of those would be the direct service positions that would be paid with federal dollars?
Ms. Walton, and Representative. In 2003, which of course was a bad budget year as well, we lost positions at that time. Customer service used to be 4 individuals. Then it went down to 3. Now we have 1.
So in a perfect world, you'd like to manage it. In a perfect world, you want to get back up to 4, is that correct?
Yes. And part of it is because of the new format,
mm-hmm.
and because our clientele is becoming more sophisticated in its questions and its needs. So instead of just ordering materials, we're also getting reference questions, research questions, etc. And that is really beyond what a volunteer could do or that the support staff could do.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We understand the issue. I think with the information that will come, maybe we can offer suggestions. Ms. Chambers, excuse me, could you also provide us for your whole agency, although we don't have your agency budget. We have just the library budget. But for the whole agency, for the department, how many FTEs are you down for the whole agency? Because I realize that in the last couple bienniums, we've reduced administration costs. And I imagine that has some impact on library services.
Yes, I will provide that.
And so we need that information too. It's all part of the big picture, right? Any information that you can provide that will help us address the issue that was dealing with the Braille and talking book library, we would appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Is someone here from Amateur Sports? Okay.
Get their name.
Okay.
Check it off. Draw a line.
I'm trying to help them too. No. If someone's listening from Amateur Sports, or someone knows where Mr. Carlson is, ring him up. And we have till 10 o'clock. I just have a question that would be helpful.
And now you have two.
No, I have two, yes. Okay, we're talking about fees. In your packets, the Historical Society submitted to us the information that we asked of them about their admissions to their various sites and their philosophy on fees. Mr. Kelleher, we haven't had an opportunity to read this in great detail yet, but just for the record, as we study this, I just have one additional question. Is there any fee that you're now collecting that you think would be helpful to raise?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm David Kelleher from the Minnesota Historical Society. As the letter outlines, we are constantly looking at the fees that we charge our visitors and patrons. There's a balance between pricing people out of the access to historic sites in the History Center and providing the access to the services that you assist in us providing. I think that you can always add a dollar or 50 cents to any of those, but there's going to be a certain drop-off in people who will turn away at the gate, and we, at some of our sites, count those turnaways for people who say, I don't want to pay that or can't pay it. So certainly any of the fees that are outlined in here can be raised 5%, 10%, and, you know, 50 cents or a dollar, but we are always hesitant to do that, to find the balance between access and maximizing revenue.
Thank you, Mr. Keller. And these were very recently. You did the study and you raised them within the last year, right?
Madam Chair, that's correct. Historic sites fees were adjusted last summer, and as you pointed out, we did do audience research, and we even did focus groups with people to gauge their ability and willingness to pay the fees at the History Center and historic sites.
Representative Hausman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And here would be the catch-22 for them, because when the Capital Investment Committee tours all these sites and they have huge capital needs, we always ask the question of how many people come here, because that is obviously a consideration. In a sense, if they help their operating budget by raising fees but it lowered visitors, then they, you know, their argument to us about the capital investment would be harder, and so I'm hoping we don't have to go here, because I think we do want people to go to all these sites in the state of Minnesota,
and we want more people. Yep. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Kelleher. I know that the Sesquicentennial Commission invested some money into subsidizing bus costs for schools, because we've heard that field trips just aren't possible with tight school budgets without some ability to apply for subsidy, and it's based on how many poor kids you have. And my understanding is that that's been quite popular. Is that correct?
Mr. Kelleher.
Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler. Yes, that has been successful, and in fact, we do at other sites have endowment funds for providing access for school kids who cannot otherwise afford to come to sites. And the example that comes to mind is Mill City Museum, where the McKnight Foundation provided funding for an endowment to provide access for lower-income schools, and those funds are depleted quickly every year. So we've tried to find opportunities to help out with access to kids who can't otherwise attend or visit historic sites and the History Center.
Oh. I think that's something we should think about in terms of our new resources and potential access issues. And I know that I've voted, I think, at least twice on the issue of free admission to the Capitol. Is that now a permanent law provision for school groups?
Mr. Kelleher.
Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler, I'm not sure that that's a permanent law, but it's been in appropriations language a couple of times, and that reference is to the tours for the general school tours that, you know, their constituents come, the school kids come to visit. Those tours are free, and that's actually one of the only places, if not the only place, where there's not an admission charge for school groups at a historic site.
That's the only place that there is not?
For school groups, Madam Chair, that's correct. We do charge school groups at the other historic sites, and their admission fee for the school activities depends on the type of service that they receive and the staffing time that it takes to do that. For example, yesterday my daughter's class came to visit the History Center, and they had a classroom lesson before they went out to the museum to look for certain things. So it costs us to have the teacher come into the classroom, and in that case they had an immigrant's trunk where they learned about people coming to this country long ago and more recently. So we have to pay the teacher, and there's an added cost for that service. So that's why we charge those school groups for that added service.
Did you bake some cornbread?
Madam Chair, I did not. I did manage to join them for lunch, but that was about all I had time to do.
You make good cornbread. And they do deserve a little snack. Okay. Any other questions for Mr. Kelleher? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Does anyone else want to come, or any of our other agencies want to come and offer something up? Maybe somebody that didn't raise their fees in the last year. Okay. Could the Children's Museum representative Barry here come and tell us about your fees? Briefly. Go ahead.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Valerie Zoslin, and I represent the Minnesota Children's Museum. Currently, which is located in downtown St. Paul, the price of a daily admission ticket is $8.95. There are, and the admission tickets provide approximately 25% of the income for the museum. There are memberships. You can become a member of the museum as well, and there are different levels, but the passport membership is the basic level, and that's $80, and that provides 12% of the income that's brought into the museum, and approximately 30% of the admissions are provided at free or reduced price for families.
What do you offer?
30%. Madam Chair, and we also provide a discounted rate for school groups to come to the, for schools to come to the museum.
And when were they raised last time?
I'm sorry, Madam Chair, I don't have that information at my fingertips. I can get that and just send it to the committee later today.
Okay, thank you. And at the Duluth Children's Museum, what do we charge?
Madam Chair, thank you very much for the opportunity to be here again today. The Duluth Children's Museum is in an unusual situation. In fact, it is the only children's museum in the nation that is in a joint-use facility shared by 9 organizations with 1 admission fee only. Therefore, daily passes to the Children's Museum are not a recoverable income to the Duluth Children's Museum. They, in fact, go to the historic Union Depot that manages the entire facility. So our revenue, which is one of our major obstacles, is zero from gate fees. People pay admission, and they get admission to the entire depot and the four exhibiting organizations. Adults pay $10, children pay $5.50, children under three are admitted free. However, the Duluth Children's Museum does retain 100% of its membership revenue, and we have aggressively grown our membership, as I've shared with you in our financial data, in our plan for relocation to Helm Street in the Heritage Center. Our membership revenue generates approximately $28,000 annually at this time. It was less than $4,000 3 years ago. We serve a membership base of 5,500 individuals. 42% of them are on a free scholarship program called Passport to Culture, which was in fact just funded by the federal government grant that appropriated dollars to the Children's Museum. We expect upon relocation that we will collect revenue from approximately 120,000 visitors annually, and that in addition to that gate revenue, we will be able to sell program service fees for educational program services, which we also currently don't retain. We turn over to the depot. And so our financial analysis shows that approximately 38% of our budget will come from daily admission fees and from program sales for educational services upon relocation.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. If I could, Madam Chair?
Yes.
One other point that I'd like to make, taking notes as I was listening to the discussion and the questions of some of my colleagues, was on the issue of upon access and opportunity. And the Duluth Children's Museum, in coming to the Cultural Heritage Committee, was, I know I have not specified an amount of request of the committee previously because we were talking about the building relocation, and that's been redirected. The Duluth Children's Museum hope is to realize $100,000 in operating support to help us specifically with the goal that you outlined, which is access for all. As a regional museum, we have expanded dramatically our service to the 180 miles that immediately surrounds Duluth. And in fact, our recent congressional appropriation and our success in just public awareness and testifying here at the state capitol has led to recent front page articles in newspapers in Bemidji, Grand Rapids, Hibbing, Virginia, Minnesota, Moose Lake, Cloquet, news reports on Minnesota Public Radio, and today I'll be interviewed on National Free Radio this evening as a result of our efforts here. All of that is leading to daily increased pressure and membership, and we anticipate our membership base growing from the current 5,500 to 25,000 in the next 3 years based on actual projections of what's happened in the last 18 months. So the demand is growing and huge.
Good. That's good news.
It is.
Yes.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much, Representative Hausman.
And, Madam Chair, it occurs to me that if there were just a rail connection to Duluth, it's possible that metro area school classes could have the adventure of getting on a train and visiting Duluth and understanding the richness of all of the museums, including the Children's Museum there.
And looking at the bridge. And the museum at the Canal Park. What a good idea. And especially if they could go at 110 miles an hour. Just zip up there and zip back home for supper. What a good idea. Representative Davis.
I was thinking more of the museum to grandma.
Well, for children?
Well, I come home for supper.
All right. We could do that. There's all kinds of possibilities. Go forth and capture them.
Madam Chair, Representative, if I can comment on the rail service and say that Duluth is very excited about the opportunity And the Children's Museum is located, as you well know, in the historic Union Depot. And as that becomes an inter-transportation and intermodal transportation hub, the urgency of things like the Duluth Children's Museum to relocate actually escalates. Because when you look at the creation of that building and its need to serve things like hospitality, food service, which it doesn't have, car rentals, and all of the things that are going to transport those many visitors and those little school children from that site to the Children's Museum, the need to be in a bigger space is even more compelling. We look forward to that day, and we look forward to working with our congressman to create a West End parking hub that will allow the Children's Museum to generate revenue as the Minnesota Children's Museum does today with the downtown parking lot that they manage in order to offset some of our revenue needs. So we're excited about that, very much so.
And Representative House and Representative Lilly, on that train, there's going to be places for your bike. And then the Children's Museum is going to be right next to the trailhead of the Munger, and you can ride the Munger Trail partway down if you don't want to go all the way to the city.
Fantastic.
And then maybe pick up the train in Hinckley and go back home.
I might need a collar roll, I think, Hinckley.
You can't tell what's going to happen. What a good idea, Representative Hausman.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
It was the suggestion of our operations director when I shared with them after my testimony that you preferred not to bike to the opening, that you would prefer to arrive in a different fashion, that perhaps the trail would accommodate rollerblading, and since he is of a similar age, that he would gladly take you on a rollerblading exposition to the library, to the museum, for our grand opening. If not, we'll make sure you arrive in style.
I'm going to consider that opportunity if you're placing before me.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
Rollerblading. We'll see. Probably not. Representative Khan.
Madam Chairman, I don't know if I've said this before this committee at all, but anyone who goes on an opening of any trail with Congressman Oberstar and attempts to keep up with him on a bicycle has better be well prepared.
Right. I just didn't want to get sweaty. I mean, I didn't want to appear before all sweaty. That was it. And usually when you cut ribbons or something, you kind of dressed up, and so I didn't want to be. So thank you very much. Mr. Carlson, welcome. I want to give you the opportunity to talk about, because I heard from somebody on the committee that we could have you raise fees to bring more money to the Amateur Sports Commission. And I seem to remember that Mr. Erickson said that makes it harder to get whole teams because the team has to pay the fee. And then there's one of our staff people last year went to an event at the Sports Center, and two events, and one was free to watch, and the other one they had to pay for the daily activities. And so I thought we need a little bit better explanation about where the fees are in your income.
Thank you, Madam Chairman and members. I apologize. I was across the hall in the very engaging debate on the Uniform Probate Act and Representative Mullery's committee. I'm Joel Carlson.
You're welcome, Representative Carlson.
And I like the train idea. I've skated the North Shore Inline Marathon 5 times now, and being able to take a train home after that experience would be very helpful. Madam Chair, Joel Carlson, I'm a member of the Minnesota Amateur Sports Commission. Happy to answer questions that I can relative to our fees that we do generate team fees for different events. Those are generally set at a level that pay for the venue and for the staffing, referees, And we set those at a level that tries to fund all of the operations, but we do not, and we feel that that the team fees that we charge are about at the maximum level that we're able to secure. We do have some events that are open to the public that are generally driven by sponsorships, but most of our venues that are tournaments, you know, we do sell tickets to for entry, but we do have some that are sponsorship driven that are open to the public. So someone might have come to an event and didn't pay an entry fee because of a sponsorship arrangement that has been arranged, but. I don't know, Madam Chair, if I can specifically answer your question in more detail, but I can tell you that after we appeared here in January, our board did have an opportunity to talk about trying to raise revenue through additional fees, as Representative Loeffler had suggested at our January meeting. And we don't feel we have the legislative authority or the economic capability to do that from our patrons beyond what we are charging right now.
Thank you very much. It was good to have that clarified and for us to hear it again before we launch our mission. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just because none of us want to cut, that's not sort of the theme of this year, unfortunately. We are really trying to make people think outside the box creatively. And while I haven't really liked corporate sponsorships of public buildings, it's sort of become the way it is. You go to the university campus and you see advertisements above classroom facilities. And have you looked at all about corporate sponsorships of this rank or that field or some of those sorts of things that might be, I mean, you have an incredible audience. I suspect there's many purveyors of goods and services that the 8 million people who visit your facility might be interested in if there might be, have you ever explored that kind of an option?
Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chair and members, we are principally driven by sponsorships. The $270,000 appropriation that we received, $300,000, we understand the times we're in, the governor's recommendation is $270,000, merely pays for the three staff people that we have and keeping the lights on. Everything else that is driven at the Amateur Sports Center and at all of our locations is driven by sponsorships and entry fees and team fees from everyone that attends the facility. So one thing that we would invite you to do is come to the Schwann Super Rink. Schwann's is is the largest sponsor of amateur sports in the state, and they are an excellent partner for us. And it is through those sponsorships that allow us to provide the programming that we do. We have at the Victory Links at the golf course, we have sponsorship on every hole. We have, we have over 1,200 kids that participate in the youth golf training program there. And so we actively promote that. I don't know where Paul Erickson is right now, but I would guarantee you that he's not on his way to meet a new or existing sponsor. He will be shortly. That is what he spends a significant amount of his time doing, and we generate a lot of revenue doing that.
Representative Hawk.
Thank you. I'd like to ask some questions on the USA Cup, which is your fine nationally renowned soccer tournament. By the way, I have a USA Cup trophy in my office, one of the very rare ones. They're pretty hard to win. Not me, my athletes. You have a team cost and an individual cost to that tournament. Is that correct?
Madam Chair and Representative Hodge, maybe defer some of the details of that particular event to Paul, but I believe that in most instances, the team fee pays for each of the individual members that participate. There may be some additional things that they may purchase, but the team fee on most of our events pays for the individual participants.
And I'll answer my own questions. Thank you. Years ago, no, I don't know if that's true now. Years ago, you had an individual fee and a team fee. And because the cost was really high, it was a major decision to play in the tournament, at least for squads coming out of our area. And the competition is really good, too. I mean, you know, but you get to meet people from Russia and Ireland and Chile and all kinds of teams that you get to play against. But there was an individual fee and a team fee, and it wasn't really, the cost was too, as in too much. But there's an awful lot of teams that play in that, and an awful lot of individuals that play in it. Do you know how many individuals or how many teams you have play in it?
Mr. Carlson.
Madam Chair and Representative Paz, with some approximation, it's the largest youth soccer tournament in the world. We have over 900 teams that participate in that event, and I believe at one point the number of participants was around 10,000 players that participate in that event.
That's what I'm getting to. Now you have an inkling factor on fees. If you have 10,000 players and you add a small amount, you still get that twitch, I wish I didn't have to pay it, but I'm not too sure I remember what I paid last year. But it was around that figure. But any small increment you add to those numbers, the end total is very, very large. Now, I know that you can't increase it, you know, $10,000 per individual, and then we'll build all kinds of stadiums all over the world because nobody would ever sign up for the tournament. But I bet a buck wouldn't be noticed. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you,
Madam Chair and members, I can tell you that we do hear from parents and families and teams that the fees that we charge are at the outer limit, and I think that it's not adding a dollar per participant on a 20-member team to their fee is going from a $600 fee to $620, $630, $650. We think that does have an impact. We think we're appropriately priced, and you know, our goal of providing those activities on a uniform basis, you know, fees can be a very significant factor for families whether or not they're able to participate. And you need to know that it's not just the entry fee. Having been a youth hockey coach and parent for over 17 years, I can tell you it's not just the ticket to get in the gate. I mean, it's travel, it is hotel, it's food. These are very, you know, people invest a significant amount of money in our economy in amateur athletics, and we think we have those fees set at the appropriate level to meet our costs and our budget. But you know, I just I think that the investment that the state makes in the Amateur Sports Commission is well placed and is not excessive, and it is the type of support that we shouldn't need to secure from our sponsors to run our base operation for our three employees and to keep the lights on.
Madam Chair, I would just like to clarify my statement. I think your fees are adequate, and when I was paying them, I thought they were too high. However, if you had added a dollar at it, I still think they were too high, but I still would have been there. Thank you.
Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I was just going to say I had a chance to meet with the executive director on the revenue thing. And one of the things that would intrigue me was he said most of the tournaments that they have, they charge a fee to the team. And then they never charge a ticket admission. And they say that, you know, their attitude is that should cover that. And when I've mostly gone to watch my nephews play hockey, I expect that I'm going to pay it to get in and watch them. And so, I mean, I think that maybe the team fees are, you know, maybe they are legitimately at what a team can absorb, because I know it's very expensive to have children and semi-pro whatever. But it is, but I think for grandmas and aunts and uncles and neighbors, they might be willing to pay a buck or two or more just to, for the experience of seeing this wonderful place and kids having a good time.
Madam Chair and members, I will clarify again with Mr. Erickson, but To be clear, we have a number of events where the spectators pay the fee. The team fee generally pays for the participant and the coaches to have free entry in and out of the venue. But we, you know, we have a number of events where we charge admission for the spectators. So that isn't the case that we never charge them. In fact, we're playing in one in about a month, the Stick It Cancer Tournament. I can tell you that the participants, the spectators that come to that do pay an admission to get in the gate, and we have staff that sit there and take the tickets. So that it is not open on all venues. There are some that are sponsor-driven where you do not pay an admission. Based on the, you know, the arrangement that's been made, but generally on these events we do charge spectators to come to the event.
Representative Khan.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know if you can give me the numbers offhand, but I would like to know what the fee for the swan naming is and what the approximate value of that fee is.
Okay. Madam Chair and President Khan, I don't know that right off the top of my head, but I, you know, I do know that that number is available, and I know that their annual sponsorship is significant, you know, very significant.
Thank you, Mr. Carlson.
And is there,
Representative Khan,
and is there a property evaluation on the stadium itself? Is there some value that is it?
Madam Chair and members, we have done appraisals and market analysis on a number of things, including the value of sponsorships. It's been my experience, both as a volunteer fundraiser and on this board, that corporations have their own idea of what the value of that sponsorship is as well, and so they place a value on that in addition to what the market may bear.
And Chairman, we're looking at things like the
Cargill
Building of Agriculture.
Oh, gosh. What have we come to? Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just want to throw this out quick. You know, as a parent of young competitive athletes, you know, I was kind of happy that my youngest is not doing traveling softball anymore. She was a state champ at 12, but I'm kind of happy now she's retired at 16, because she's in music, and we pay for special tutors in that, and with piano, drum, and vocal, and then you add competitive sports, and then you pay fees to get into everything. And quite honestly, an average family like mine, we are just killed. So do you support your child, and then you have, I mean, the fees just going to these things are amazing, and then you eat and you spend a weekend somewhere. I mean, I don't know how people can afford, and then you get in this situation where honestly only the wealthiest of people can play, and then it's rather sad. So anyway.
Sometimes they bring auntie along, and auntie is financially well off and shares wealth, but she gets crazy about the fees too. So, but they're kind of like what Representative Hodge said. You don't like them, but you pay, auntie pays them, and then.
I never did that.
You know, there it goes. Thank you, Mr. Carlson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Anyone else want to come forth and talk about fees? Going? Oh, Adelman.
Madam Chair, Peggy Adelman, Chief Financial Officer of the Minnesota Zoo. I thought I would just update you on where we are. In the governor's recommendation, the governor reduced our general fund appropriation by 10%, which is equivalent to $700,000, and suggested that we look at making up half of that with fees and then half of that with expenditure reductions. So our board has not acted on anything and won't until June, but the kinds of things that we're looking at, we look at our membership fees. The last time those were raised was July of 07, and we're looking at increasing all of the categories except individuals by $10. And we look at the market. and we look at how many times if a family comes to the zoo that would be covered, and we believe that the market will bear that one, and we're not too concerned. The other thing we're looking at with our admission fees, in this economy, you always hesitate to increase fees. So we're looking at trying to get creative and go to a seasonal pricing, because there are some things that we offer in the summer that aren't offered in the winter. The butterflies this year will have Africa. So we're looking at increasing our fee in the summer, but then in the winter, reducing it actually from what we are at now. And when we run the numbers, that brings in a little bit additional revenue. And again, we do the library passes and the community action passes to try and be accessible to all income levels.
Thank you. That was helpful. Representative Lauper.
Have you been able to do any research, thank you, Madam Chair, on the family memberships and relate that to how many people sign up for a family membership and just come like maybe once or twice, and they, you know, they like getting the publication in the mail, as opposed to people who might live nearby and come every other weekend? And I've always kind of wondered a little bit about that, because I think for people who live close to our facilities, it really is a good deal if you go a lot. But I'm wondering if that's really a small part of your overall membership. I'm not sure.
Ms. Adelman.
Madam Chair and Representative Rockwood, in our ideal world, we want to go to barcoding, where we actually could track members and how many times they come. We're not able to do that. But we do track zip code information, so we can see where our members live, and then it's anecdotal. We do have a number of people who may come once a week, and a lot of our members are from the Seven County metro area. However, we actually have members from all but, I believe, 14 counties in Minnesota. So we do have a base who just supports the zoo and want to make that contribution. The foundation also has a friends society where you get all of the membership benefits and then access to some behind-the-scenes types of things. And that's really more for people who support the zoo and want to make a financial contribution over and above the kind of coming for the admission purposes.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Allman.
Thanks, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Brenda Rainey from the Science Museum of Minnesota. Just on the topic of studies, we have discussed this before, but a few points I want to make sure that you remember. We do strive to keep our fees in line with other family entertainment and education options around the state and the metro area. We hesitate, as everyone here has said, to raise fees and put the access to the museum out of reach of families. One of the things that we do offer is our Great Picks program, which gives families who are already receiving public assistance from another form the opportunity to visit the museum for $1, which is a significant decrease over the ticket price for an adult to see both the Omni Theater and the exhibits. Right now we're at $16 for that ticket. Omni Theater only is $7.50. And exhibits only is $11. Students and children under the age of 12 come in for less than that. The child price ranges from $6.50 to $13. And a school group will come in at $5 a student, and that price has not been increased since 2005. Another point to make, in addition to fees, we are fortunate enough and have a developed enough budget that we have alternative revenue streams that we're constantly assessing to see if we can maximize those rather than increase our fees. So we have exhibits for rent and exhibits for sale that we do. We do an awful lot of grant work that we can then turn around and leverage into additional income for the museum, and that's a great way to, especially in these kinds of times, raise some money that doesn't impact our visitors.
I think that's about all, and I'd be happy to take questions.
You covered pretty well the other day, when the presentation, Mr. Jolly, Dr. Jolly gave a pretty good rundown of those things. So you weren't even on my list today.
Well, it's always good to have another chance, but...
Representative Loeffler has a question.
Yeah. Madam Chair, this would be to all the groups that do continuing ed for teachers. I noted in the Historical Society, and thank you very much, this is really useful, that they gave us kind of a range of what they charge teachers. And I think most of the organizations that we support have some component like that. And if we could just get information just to see how comparable they are, that might be useful as well, because I know that's an important part of continuing ed for teachers, and it's a wonderful learning opportunity, but just to see if they're kind of everybody sort of in the same range or if there's possibilities there.
That'd be great. Thank you very much, Ms. Rainey.
Thank you.
Mr. Romanstein, do you want to come down and address what Ms. Loeffler just talked about, since you're trying to save your baby with the help of Representative Kahn?
Good morning, Madam Chair. Our fees are derived primarily from two sources. One, from fees that we charge for programs, primarily the K-12 educators. We did attempt to increase those fees at the in the summer in anticipation of the new academic year. We raised those fees to $145 for a two-day seminar, including all books, materials, et cetera. My understanding is that put us right in the market, but we very quickly saw almost a 50% slump in enrollments for those seminars. And when we surveyed teachers, teachers said to us overwhelmingly that they simply could not afford the fees. The fall was a difficult time. We reduced the fees. We cut the fees back to $75 for a two-day seminar, and we are back to standing room only crowds for all of our seminars. So I think there's a direct correlation, and we deemed that it was more important to serve the needs of the teachers than it was to generate revenue. The second source of revenue for us as far as a fee base is concerned is the rental of the Meeting and Event Center, a historic building located on the east side of St. Paul. A lot of our clients are state agencies, the Department of Revenue, the Department of Natural Resources. The other part of that base are other nonprofit and educational organizations. School districts use our building for administrative retreats, for faculty retreats. We've done a pretty careful survey, and what we've heard from all of those folks is we're having a hard enough time renting your building now. To raise the rates is going to be detrimental to us. Business in the Meeting and Event Center is off almost 40% over this same period last year, and those numbers compare favorably with other Meeting and Event Centers, conference centers, rentals, etc. It's something that we're seeing throughout. People simply don't have the money to do it. So we don't see a real opportunity to generate new revenues. There was some discussion earlier, we are looking at sponsorships for upcoming conferences. We are hosting a national conference on equity and the future of black education in America, a national conversation on closing the achievement gap and doing better by African American kids. We're looking for business sponsorships for that, as well as for a number of other conferences, but we are, like everybody else, looking into new places for revenue.
Thank you very much.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair.
The 10 o'clock hour is here. Representative Morgan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll move the minutes of Monday, March 23, as submitted.
All in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion is adopted. Members in your packet are still two bills. Representative Davis, 1208 and 1652, that we did not once again get to, but they have very interesting ideas in them, and so please read through them and as you're thinking of ways to that we will go together, we will go forth and put together our final bill, especially the bill on the constitutional amendment funding. Give some thought to these two ideas that hopefully we'll get to one day, but I will think about them now before that time comes. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
This meeting is adjourned.